Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. Recent leadership and policy changes have caused upheaval in the Wyoming Department of Education, but the collection and processing of data has been insufficient for years. An audit of the WDE's Information Management Unit is showing that there are major flaws in the system and that an overhaul of the department is in order. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez reports.
The legislature's Joint Education Committee heard the findings of a report by RTI International, the private auditing group that was hired to assess the Wyoming Department of Education's ability to collect, maintain, and provide information about Wyoming schools. RTI found a lot of internal problems, specifically with the Information Management, or IM, unit's ability to meet data processing demands. The report found that it has an incomplete strategic plan, weak technology standards, and an ineffective organizational structure. Representative Matt Teeters co-chairs the Joint Education Committee. He says he suspected these problems, but that the WDE can't continue this way.
Data really is the lifeblood of the Department of Education. They're primarily a compliance agency, and they primarily collect information. And if we don't have the ability to do that, we don't have the ability to function properly.
The data, enrollment, attendance, test scores, that pass through the department's IM unit are critical in making decisions about school resources, staffing, and funding. Last summer, WDE briefly released incorrect federal annual yearly progress numbers for many Wyoming schools before recalling and correcting them. R.J. Cost is the curriculum coordinator in Park County School District 1. He says errors in collection or release of data could have real consequences for schools.
You know, it could affect funding, depending on what the reports are and the number of students involved with certain courses, help determine the amount of money that is funded for those particular courses, which obviously would be a direct effect on student education. So I think we have to be careful to make sure that we're accurately reporting to protect that.
Cost also says the Department of Education requires schools to submit different reports in different formats that often duplicate information. He says it takes more time and manpower on his end to file all the reports that WDE requests, which he thinks could be streamlined if the department were more organized.
The people working for the WDE are really trying to do the best job for the students in the state of Wyoming, but I think that unfortunately, sometimes the right and the left hand haven't communicated very well.
They have a tough job to do. Federal reporting standards and technology change often and are hard to keep up with. There was some staff turnover when Superintendent Cindy Hill was elected in 2010. And that same year, the state of Wyoming created the Department of Enterprise Technology Services, a sort of centralized information technology department that serves all state agencies. ETS absorbed about half of the WDE's IM unit. The plan was not to hinder the Department of Education, but Alan Moore says that's what it did. Before he became a data research analyst at Laramie County School District 1 2 years ago, he was the director of the Standards and Assessment Unit at the Department of Education. He says many of the people he's seen move from the IM unit to ETS were not general IT experts.
WD lost quite a few people with pretty deep expertise and institutional knowledge, so that has been a problem. I don't think that capacity has been replaced, both in terms of the number of people that it requires and also in the skill set of the people that are there.
So the IM unit is understaffed and disorganized, but maintains the same workload. And that workload is about to grow immensely when new state accountability measures go into full effect. Moore says it would be impossible for the current IM unit to handle the influx of data needed to rank schools, teachers, and administrators across the state. The RTI report advised the WDE to hire three positions immediately. State Superintendent Cindy Hill says she feels vindicated as she fought against losing IM staff to the ETS consolidation.
I told the governor on several occasions that we'd be shorthanded and that we needed to keep these positions plus others. So it's perplexing to me that we're having this conversation.
The Joint Education Committee has asked the governor to put off absorbing any more IM staff into ETS for the time being. The Department of Education has until the end of July to submit its budget plan for the 2015-16 biennium and reorganize the department's entire staffing structure. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
The new supervisor of the Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission is Grant Black. Since he started the job a few weeks ago, he's been dealing with issues ranging from the flaring of natural gas to water contamination. He says the flaring issue is interesting.
One of the most important things about the issue of flaring is that all parties have the facts and they have the information and the details and the statistics. It's easy to come to a conclusion that may or may not be appropriate if you don't have all the facts. And I think educating parties on the reasons why flaring is taking place, the challenges that the industry has, as well as the concerns that the public and other stakeholders have with respect to doing it. But I think that policymakers can establish the right path if it does need to be changed, if they have those facts.
Is the taxation, I mean, is that something normally that's done? Is it unusual that we haven't been doing that here?
You know, I really don't have enough knowledge and history to address that issue.
One of the things that we heard from some of the residents up in Douglas, where I guess this really got a lot of people's attention because it was very close to homes, is that a unique situation that maybe is different than maybe, you know, flaring out somewhere in the middle of Wyoming somewhere?
Well, obviously, flaring in closer proximity to people and other environmentally sensitive, even wildlife or other things, brings more attention to the matter. But flaring is not something that occurs widely. There are certainly areas where it's a little more consolidated, and that's simply because of the availability of infrastructure to produce the gas into a pipeline and to avoid flaring.
Wait, is there a compromise here? I mean, I'm sure you've been thinking about it. What are you talking to legislators about?
Well, we simply educated legislators on the rules and the policies and the approach that we've taken to flaring so that they do have an understanding of, in particular, the obstacles that the operators have to get the wells hooked up and online and the circumstances and the data and the factors that we take into consideration when we approve a flaring.
Grant Black visiting with us today. Let me ask you a little bit about baseline testing. It's something that obviously you walk right into here. We have the governor and other people thinking this is a key thing as the state moves forward. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, as a scientist, I'm a geologist by education. I always think that it's important to have the facts, as I've said before. And the facts in certain circumstances begin from as early as possible. It's very difficult to make a determination as to whether impact has occurred if you don't have an understanding of what it was originally. So, therefore, I think a baseline testing program can certainly be beneficial if it's properly implemented.
Is it more important that maybe than ever as you start looking at people coming down on fracking and some of these other issues as development continues? I mean, has it become even more important to get that baseline testing?
It's hard to be proactive instead of reactive, but clearly as we get more evidence and information, I think we can consider putting policies in place that will help us in the future, and that's effectively what this baseline testing should hopefully do.
So is our plan to make this the norm now? This will always happen?
We are in the development of a rule that will be considered pursuant to our rules to adopt. I think that obviously, as in the fracking rule that Wyoming has, Wyoming has been a leader in that sort of thing. And while Wyoming isn't the first state to have a rule with respect to baseline testing, I think that we've looked at how other states have done it, and we're going to take an approach to do the best job we can to have something here, recognizing that, as I think hope all of us realize, whether it's a rule or a law, it's consistently being reviewed and considered for change.
When you look at our fracking rule, obviously, I think right around the time you got hired, we had a judge's decision on this, and there are a lot of people that would like to get more information publicly. What's going to be your, I guess, as you decide what should be released and what shouldn't be, what's going to be your thought process?
Well, I think what is released and what isn't, and I think we need to keep this in mind in this whole process, is it is a democratic process. There are checks and balances, and if a party believes that something is not released that should be, then they have the right and the potential to take action to do that in a legal manner. But I think that we have to take all considerations. And a good example would be In other states, when they've looked at this rule, they've looked at the aspect of should any information be released to medical professionals. And I think that's clearly a case where, you know, that needs to be given special consideration when it deals mm-hmm. with human life and health. So there's a lot of factors that we take into consideration in all of this.
So some people might get more access to it than others. I'm not putting words in your mouth, I hope.
Well, no, I certainly wouldn't say that. I would say that it's on a need basis. I think that, and I can't speak specifically to Wyoming because I haven't studied the rule mm-hmm. word for word, but I know that the issue of the appropriate release of information to medical professionals has been an issue in other areas. And that would just be one example mm-hmm. where the whole trade secret aspects of things is important, but I think we have to balance that with the need. One thing that I would hope the general public would recognize that, you know, many of the constituents that are presently used in fracking materials are commonly used in households. And so it's important to get the facts before you come to a conclusion that may not be completely informed.
And they might be in the household, but maybe not in your drinking water, and I think that's where some folks are concerned.
An example I would use, and I would encourage folks to look at various sources, that there are some, if not many, of the chemicals that you put on your body every day in the form of a lotion or something like that. So, I think the mm-hmm. the importance is to not automatically assume that there's something hidden that's damaging to you, but seek the facts and understand that there are many things that are used that are common in everyday occurrences in our lives.
Mr. Black, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome, and I appreciate you allowing me to do this.
Grant Black is the new supervisor of the Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission.
When we come back, we'll have the latest installment in our Upstart series. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. In our occasional series on upstart businesses, we take you to Laramie to tell you about a software company that's making a dent in the world of medicine. Mona Gamboa started Happy Jack Software in 2004 after she left her software job in Texas to join her husband, who took a job at the University of Wyoming. Gamboa got a Master in Science in e-business from UW and started Happy Jack Software in the UW Student Union. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
When Happy Jack Software began, Mona Gamboa joined forces with a UW professor who worked with her in developing an online scheduling system for educators.
That product was not very successful. It didn't work out very well.
The biggest problem is that it went head-to-head with the launch of Google Calendar. Happy Jack Software then went to the Laramie-based Business Incubator, where she worked with a pharmaceutical firm in Casper to develop software for pharmacies, long-term care, assisted living, and home health care providers. And they developed their most popular product called MedRite. The software was meant to keep track of the medicines they're dispensing.
Avoids overdosing patients and letting them get their meds on time. And it's used in facilities where they give medications all the time.
They eventually graduated from the incubator and moved into a technology building in Laramie, where they continue to build software for the medical industry. One of the things they learned is that Medicare was setting some new rules that might allow them to expand their business, and that's what happened. For instance, there's a need now for long-term care facilities and nursing homes to keep an eye on the care they provide.
Medicare reimburses homes based on documentation, and so we automated the documentation for assisted daily living activities for long-term care facilities. Then we moved into the wound area, and we released our mobile app for WoundRite, which tracks wounds and the healing of wounds.
And they developed a mobile app to help home health care providers more easily document their care of patients. Gamboa says reporting requirements in the Affordable Care Act have also opened up some more opportunities to develop products. The people developing the software sit in front of computers in a large room. The employees are dressed casually. There is little conversation and just occasional typing. Developing software apparently is a quiet business. The first person Gamboa hired was Eric Despain, who's the senior software developer. He joined them when they were in the incubator, and he's amazed with how far they've come.
It seems like every time we hire a new person, I think of back when we were in one little, probably 15-foot by 15-foot office in the back of a building somewhere to where we are now. It's remarkable how much we've changed and how much we've been able to improve people's lives.
And Despain does believe they're helping their clients do their jobs better.
I do the graphical interfaces for everybody, so I have the challenge of helping nurses who are not computer savvy use a computer to get their job done faster. And so I really enjoy the challenge of making it easy.
Newest employee Spencer Buda is working on their latest attempt to branch out.
I've been assigned to work on a new product that we have called MedRite Mobi. It's going to be a mobile version of a product that we've had for a long time called MedRite, which is it's for managing medications. This one is specifically being designed for correctional facilities.
Happy Jack Software currently employs 19 people, and both Despain and Gamboa says they've been able to hire a number of University of Wyoming graduates and keep them in state. And apparently, it's a highly sought-after job. Buddha loves what he does.
It's a lot of fun. It's very exciting. I guess the goal of programming is to tell a computer very explicitly what you want it to do. It's all about logic, and that logic is just problem-solving. It's puzzles.
And what's better than working on puzzles? Gamboa says they're also working on customized software for other businesses. And remember that calendar she mentioned earlier? They finally developed a version that is becoming popular. And programmer Eric Despain says it's exciting to be a competitive worldwide business in Laramie. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Historian Phil Roberts at the University of Wyoming recently published a book called Cody's Cave, which tells the story of a vast set of caverns near Cody. The cave was once a national monument, but was then turned over to local control, and Roberts argues that was a grave mistake, because the site is now just a hole in the ground, off limits to the public. Roberts joins us now to talk about the cave and its demise.
The cave was found in January of 1909 when a fellow by the name of Ned Frost from Cody was up hunting bobcats with his dog. And suddenly the bobcat disappeared and the dog chased the bobcat behind this ledge. And what had happened is that they had gone into a cave. And Ned Frost took a look and he saw that this was a pretty big cave. And so a week later, he sent a group of people up to take a longer look at the cave. And included with that party was William F. Cody, Buffalo Bill. The cave goes deep into Cedar Mountain, and there are all kinds of chambers and passageways that are just honeycombed through that mountain.
Now, initially, this cave was in federal hands, then eventually it got transferred to the city of Cody. How did that happen?
It was interesting how it became a national monument, because Wyoming had, of course, the nation's first national monument with Devil's Tower. And this was only 3 years after Devil's Tower was created that this cave was found. Within 9 months, Shoshone Caverns National Monument was created by proclamation of President Taft. And Buffalo Bill thought that this would be a perfect tourist destination to help his new town of Cody.
But it ended up turning out that it was not an easy monument for the Park Service to run, essentially. So what happened there?
Well, the cave was, of course, found before the Park Service was created. And so initially, the administration of it was handed over to the superintendent of Yellowstone National Park. And the superintendent of Yellowstone had a tough enough time trying to take care of his huge domain up there without thinking about a cave 50 miles outside the borders of the park. And so even early on, they recognized that it would take a huge amount of money to make it accessible. And it would take a large amount of money to get a road built to up to the site, because it was a pretty tough climb.
And so the federal government was happy to get rid of this. Why did Cody want the cave?
Well, all the way through this time, the city of Cody was complaining about the fact that this cavern had been neglected, that there wasn't an easy access up there, and that the Park Service, every time that the city of Cody would ask them, well, what are you doing about the caverns, they would say, well, that's sort of a secondary mission of ours. We're really more interested in Yellowstone National Park. And of course, most people in Cody were more interested in Yellowstone Park. And so the very few people who thought that the caverns could turn into something kept pressing the Park Service until finally, through a combination of factors, Congress authorized the delisting of Shoshone Caverns National Monument and essentially handed over to the city of Cody. And of course, the city of Cody initially thought that they could do what the Park Service had not been able to do. And of course, they were very willing to do it, but I don't believe a lot of people involved in the project initially recognized the impediments. It was going to be expensive, and it was going to be very difficult to make that cave accessible. A project of that scope was way beyond the means of a small town. The cavern was operated by the concessionaire for the city of Cody. He finally gave up because it was just way too expensive and it was just not profitable to keep going. He handed it back to the city of Cody, and about 10 years passed and nothing much was done. So in 1977, the city council of Cody very quietly turned it over to the federal government, to the Bureau of Land Management. So it's now BLM land, and it's not accessible to the public. And I think it's an object lesson for how to treat national monuments and parks and other federal lands, because sometimes, even though the federal government might not be doing exactly what the local people want them to do, at least the resource was being protected. And there was some amount of thought going into the fact that at some time in the future, there may be an opportunity to take advantage of that resource as a tourist destination. So I think it's a really dangerous proposition to advocate that the federal government dispose of its control over federal lands in the West.
Phil Roberts is author of Cody's Cave. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about concerns that trapping of wolves could end up killing unintended targets. And we'll look at why migratory elk around Yellowstone are raising fewer calves than in the past. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. Author and historian Mac Bleuer has written an entertaining book called Wyoming's Outlaw Trail. It's about the outlaws that frequented Wyoming in the late 1800s and early 1900s. For instance, he says Bags, Wyoming was a popular hangout.
Bags, Wyoming was a very important place, especially to the Wild Bunch. Elsie Lay was married. Elsie Lay, who was Butch Cassidy's right-hand man before the Sundance Kid was married to a woman there with the Calvert family. Butch Cassidy and Elsie Lay and others probably worshipped at St. Luke's Church there. They also used adjacent areas in Powder Wash and Browns Park to hide out in. And the Wild Bunch would come into town and party at a place called the Bulldog Saloon. And so, yes, absolutely. Bags is actually one of the most important outlaw towns probably in the American West. And you're right in what you say, but it is in terms of the American West, especially the Wild Bunch, Bags was the place to be if you were a friend of Butch Cassidy.
Now, when we talk about this time period, and we talked about this actually before we started, but it just seems like a very lawless, a scary time.
It was, and I'm glad you brought that up, Bob. In the book, I talk about the dangers of romanticizing the past, and I think that especially in Wyoming, we like to romanticize this golden age of the 1880s and 1890s. But if you look at the realities of the age, it was an awful time to be around. There was the Johnson County War. There were people killing each other and lynching each other in the streets in Laramie and Wyoming. There were small ranchers killing larger ranchers killing smaller ranchers. There's total social unrest. So I think I do talk about this in the book, but that's actually the reason – actually, but those reasons, those dark – that dark age was part of the reason why some of these outlaws flourished, like the Wild Bunch. All that social unrest led to the rise of the Wild Bunch. Those conditions were perfect for the rise of heroes. And people like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Elsie Leigh, Kid Curry, they were all social outlaws. They needed friends in the ranching community, and I think they took advantage of those times. So,
drives you to like Butch Cassidy so much? It's very clear in your book that you talk about him and I guess what is mentioned in the movie about him that most people would know about, where he didn't, I guess, necessarily kill anyone, or at least documented evidence of shooting anyone, seems to play a role in this. But why you like, because he was kind of a bad guy.
You know, very true. Butch Cassidy is a very complicated character. And I think that we make assumptions about him. I think if you look at the different folkloric archetypes, he fits under every one. I mean, he was a good guy, a kind of Robin Hood figure to some. He was a bad man, a killer to others. He was kind of a trickster to others. I think that most of the evidence, the weight of the evidence, shows that Butch Cassidy was a fairly kind man. He did not like killing. And he did look after the smaller ranchers and some of the common folk of Wyoming and the American West. However, there is kind of the selfish side of the social outlaws, that he needed these networks of support to survive. So if he ever was going to get away from these posses in bags or in lander, he needed friends. So there's that element too. But I think every age needs its heroes. And even if we simplify those heroes and those people, I think it's important still to believe in them. And Butch Cassidy was, in terms of these robbers out there, he was the golden standard. He was the golden boy. Everyone wanted to be Butch Cassidy because he was to many kind of this folkloric hero, someone who took on the Union Pacific Railroad and the stock growers. And he was different. Even the Pinkertons, actually, in their memos, the Pinkerton Detective Agency said that the Wild Bunch ascribed to a higher standard because they killed fewer people. So we know – now, that's perhaps not praise, but that's true. However, there were other criminals, and some of them were just thugs and killers. And then there were some criminals who were victims. So those three types of criminals kind of come out in this book.
I mean, even were you surprised – you're a bit of a historian, obviously. This is what you do. But were you surprised with all of the – I guess the thuggery and some of the things that went on in this state? I mean, I think it's undersold sometimes.
I agree. The stories, if you were to read half the stories, it's appalling what happened here. And some of the characters, they were not – people you wanted to associate yourself with. Jack Slade, for instance. Jack Slade worked for the Overland Express Company. He worked for the government, and he made sure that the stagecoaches and the mail coaches went through. Virginia Dale, just over the border of Wyoming, is named after his wife, Virginia. But he was slighted. He and another man, Jules Benny, got into an argument. Jules Benny shot him with a shotgun. 9 months later, after he recovered, he found this man. He shot him over the course of 24 hours nearly 30 times in front of all these horrified passengers and while he was drinking whiskey. And then he puts this man out of his misery. He cuts off his ears and wears them as gruesome tokens of his victory over this poor man. And later he would nail one of these ears to a hitching post in Virginia Dale. I'm kind of glad to say that later in life he tried to kill a judge in northern Colorado, and he was lynched by a mob of 600 citizens even after the judge tried to save his life. So again, some of these characters were awful people, like Jack Slade and Big Nose George and others. So some of them were just thugs. They weren't social outlaws. They were thugs.
What changed? What I guess got us away from that?
Well, I do think that there's the rise of the lawmen, and I do think that the West became more settled, and people wouldn't tolerate killing and robbery as much as they did in the early days.
Very easy read, lots of pictures, a lot of fun to read. Wyoming's Outlaw Trail, the author is Mac Bleuer. Max, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much, Bob. I appreciate you having me.
Since wolves have been taken off the endangered species list in Wyoming, they can now be hunted in many parts of the state, and they can also be trapped in areas where they're classified as predators. Rebecca Huntington reports that that's raising concerns that unintended animals could end up in the traps.
So this is the way the device sits, and when an animal, again, it could be at any height, when an animal goes into it.
Dave Polly is an animal rescuer who works for the Humane Society of the United States. He's running a workshop at the Old Wilson Schoolhouse at the foot of Teton Pass to teach dog owners how to keep their pets safe from wildlife traps. He stresses that wildlife traps can be found just about anywhere on public lands where wildlife is present. That's a lesson Buffalo Valley resident Penny Maldonado, who is attending the workshop, learned the hard way. She was walking her 3-year-old yellow lab along the Buffalo Fork River the day after Christmas.
And she got ahead of me, just like they said. And I called and called her, and she came back.
And that's when Maldonado noticed her dog bleeding from the mouth. So she lifted up her lip to investigate.
And her teeth were gone.
Maldonado discovered a trap nearby that her dog had sprung and somehow escaped. She took her to the vet, who found metal ground into every tooth. Maldonado says the trap was for small animals, probably beaver or marten. But now in areas where wolves are classified as predators, Polly says larger, more lethal traps could be set for wolves.
The severity of the trap, when you have large wolf-sized traps, 7.5, 9-inch jaw spreads, or you have 10-inch body grip traps, those are unforgiving.
And Polly worries that these larger traps could catch more unintended targets.
Devices that are going to catch wolverines and mountain lions, a lot of non-target animals. In Montana, they caught 9 non-target mountain lions in one trapping district.
Polly's workshop is being put on by Wyoming Wolves Untrapped, a predator advocacy group that formed after Wyoming took over management of wolves. Although based in Wyoming, the group also worries about wolf trapping in other states, including Idaho, where wolf trappers accidentally caught more than 200 non-target species in a single trapping season. In Wyoming, numbers of how many non-target species are caught in traps set for wolves or for other wildlife are hard to come by. Reporting isn't generally required. But numbers are available from the Federal Wildlife Services, which often traps wolves and coyotes, as well as other species, in response to complaints of damage. Last year, Wildlife Services unintentionally trapped 2 grizzly bears, mule deer, a golden eagle, a dozen bobcats, and many other non-target species. The grizzlies were freed alive. A veterinarian at the workshop says his clinic has treated dogs for degloving, when a trap pulls a dog's skin off of its limbs. Polly says there have been a handful of reported instances of unintended encounters in Teton County in the past year.
Question was asked how many dogs have been reported in this community, and it was 4 or 5 that were reported. I guarantee you it's 4 or 5 times that were caught, but people just got them out and didn't do anything.
After demonstrating a variety of traps, Polly takes people outside so they can practice releasing Trapper.
Well, just try it once. Pull on the leash, see what happens. He's going to come with it.
A stuffed animal that looks like a collie that he borrowed from his daughter.
3 years ago, I was doing one of these workshops, and I said, can I borrow Trapper and... for this trapping demo? And she was like, well, is he going to be okay? And I said, he's going to save a lot of dogs. He's going to help save dogs. And she said, sure.
Polly lists ways that dog owners can keep their pets safer, such as keeping them on leashes and carrying a variety of first aid supplies.
I made a list after tonight.
Sarah Hoffman plans to add items from cable cutters to a strong leash to her backpack. This is the first time she's worried about her dog, but it's not the first time she's worried about trapping.
I worried about it for the wild animals. It really bothers me. It's always bothered me ever since I was a little kid.
She draws a line between trapping and hunting.
My family's always hunted, and I eat game meat. I'm supportive of hunting. I'm just not supportive of suffering.
What upsets Hoffman is that a wild animal might not die quickly and could suffer for days in a trap before the trap is ever checked. Trapping regulations in Wyoming vary depending on whether the wild animal is deemed a predator or trophy game. Polly says the state's trapping rules could use an overhaul to make them more clear, consistent, and humane. But he also defends trappers' intentions.
Most trappers are conscientious and they don't want to catch a dog.
Still, Polly says, pet owners need to be mindful, especially in the parts of Wyoming where larger, more lethal traps are being set for wolves. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Huntington.
Since the 1990s, elk that migrate between Yellowstone National Park and Cody have been raising fewer calves. But the elk that stay in the foothills near Cody year-round and don't migrate have been doing very well. A new study looks at why that's the case. We're joined now by the lead author on the report, Arthur Middleton. He says they spent years looking at the elk's predators and habitat and how those corresponded to elk pregnancies and overall well-being.
Essentially, we found that migratory elk had low pregnancy rates. They had, in that first year, about a 59% pregnancy rate, which is kind of pretty strikingly low for elk. Rocky Mountain elk usually have about a 90% rate of pregnancy. And resident elk had that typical rate of about 90%. So we saw this low pregnancy of these migratory elk. And what that seems to be is an influence of drought in the region. So low pregnancy means fewer calves are born, but then you got to get down to only, you know, so 70% over 4 years of these elk were pregnant. But by the end of the summer, there's only about 15 calves per 100 cows. So the calf numbers are still dropping. And that's where we see this influence of recovering predators, wolves and grizzly bears. As many people know, wolves were reintroduced and proceeded to grow in numbers and expand. But at the same time, grizzly bear numbers were growing in the landscape. And grizzly bears, it turns out, are the primary predator of elk calves. And so we could explain the rest of this decline in elk calf production among the migrants by these high summer predation levels, particularly by bears, but also by wolves. Residents, meanwhile, have access to irrigated agriculture, hay and alfalfa fields, and they benefit from the removal of predators. I mean, one of the interesting things there is that we think of migration as a strategy to get better food and to escape from predators that make their dens down on these winter ranges or near winter ranges. It actually seems like it's the residents who, in this case, are starting to gain these dual benefits of a migratory strategy.
So what does all of this mean from a wildlife management perspective? I mean, do you have advice for wildlife managers or things they might take away from this?
Well, it's a good question, and I think that it's relevant kind of on two scales. At one sort of broader scale, you know, this is a story about migration. It's hard in our ever more developed world to sustain these longer distance animal movements. Elk in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem move between 25 and 85 miles twice each year between their seasonal ranges. That's really unique. That's something that people generally want to conserve. But here we're seeing that those benefits of migration are seeming to be diminished relative to the benefits of residency. This doesn't mean migratory elk are going to disappear. They're going to persist. But this suggests that we ought to be paying attention to these subtle landscape changes, changes in how predators are managed, changes in the distribution of what elk like to eat as we think about how to sustain migratory animals. It's not always about fences and roads and obstructions to migration. It can also be about how these resources and risks are distributed on the landscape. More locally and regionally, you know, many people are asking, well, you know, what does this kind of work mean for the way that we manage predators? And there's a lot of interest in wolves because of recent changes in their management. Does this mean that wolves aren't, you know, playing a role in reducing elk populations or elk calf recruitment? No, it doesn't mean that. But it means that there are these other factors that are at play that are also limiting elk calf numbers. And so that means that we need to take those other factors, another key predator, grizzly bears, as well as changing habitat conditions into account. And in some areas, if those factors more strongly limit elk calf numbers, then reducing wolf numbers in the expectation of growing more elk calves might not, you know, bring as much of a return as we expect.
Is it actually a worry, though, if fewer elk are surviving or if they're having fewer babies? I mean, obviously, we used to have more predators in the Yellowstone area.
Right.
Are we really not going back to just kind of how it used to be?
That's a really, really good question. And so, yes, I mean, we sort of expected this to happen to some degree when these large carnivores that eat elk were recovered in the system. And so in some ways, this is not surprising, and we might be arriving back at something a little bit more similar to what was there previously. But what this raises is the need to think about whether the drought effects we're seeing are linked to a longer-term change in the regional climate. If those migratory elk continue to experience those poorer summer foraging conditions, which, as we've seen, it is a shorter spring green-up, that's why they migrate, essentially, is to get that newly emergent green vegetation. So future changes or ongoing reductions in that resource on the landscape could be novel. It's not entirely clear yet. And the second thing is the key calf predator in this system, grizzly bears, we now know that their diets are changing. They're losing some important diet items. They're very opportunistic, they're omnivorous, and when they lose one important diet item, they look for something else to eat. And there's starting to be some pretty good evidence that some grizzly bears in the system are consuming more elk calves as they lose other diet items. And so to answer your question, there are these pieces of what we've been seeing that suggest we ought not to be alarmed, but we also may not want to be complacent that we're simply arriving back at a historical sort of baseline, particularly in light of climatic changes and changing predator behavior, particularly of grizzly bears.
All right. Well, Arthur, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Arthur Middleton has a PhD in ecology from UW. His study about migratory elk was published in the journal Ecology.
When we come back, we'll travel to South Africa, where wildlife managers face challenges with growing elephant populations. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. We've reported frequently on efforts to control wildlife numbers in Wyoming through hunting, contraception, and other means. In southern Africa, wildlife managers face similar challenges with elephants. In some parts of Africa, elephants are threatened by poaching, but in South Africa, they're flourishing. Some wildlife reserves say they're multiplying too fast, but others say controlling their numbers is the wrong solution. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden traveled to South Africa and filed this report.
It's a sunny afternoon at Makalali Game Reserve. Giraffes graze at the edge of savannas, wildebeests gather beneath flat-topped trees, and elephants amble through leafy thickets. The reserve is home to all of South Africa's big game species, and visitors pay top dollar to go on safaris here. My driver stops his jeep near an elephant herd.
So the elephant, they eat 24 hours. Wherever you find them, they will be eating.
And sure enough, the elephants wander from tree to tree, wrap their trunks around branches, and pull off huge mouthfuls of leaves. Sometimes they even knock over a tree to reach high up branches. The animals at Makalali seem to be living in the wild, but this is a fenced-in reserve, and the wildlife is closely managed. Most notably, many of the elephants are on birth control. Audrey Delsink is in charge of them. She explains that when elephants were reintroduced to Makalali in the 1990s, their population ballooned.
And it's simply because the resources are so phenomenal. You know, elephants hadn't been here for many, many years, and so the vegetation is ideal. In most instances, there's artificial water, and so this just makes for wonderful breeding grounds.
Those conditions are common in South Africa. The elephants all live in parks and game reserves where there's almost no poaching, few predators, and abundant water. So the animals live long and multiply quickly. Henk Birchinger, an expert in veterinary science and animal reproduction from the University of Pretoria, says the problem with that is that game reserves have a finite amount of space.
And if you don't control the elephant numbers, they're going to destroy the habitat.
Destroy the habitat as in eat every plant in sight. But controlling elephant numbers is tricky. Sending the animals away is rarely an option because South Africa's parks are full, and moving them to other countries would be expensive and a political nightmare. And killing elephants is often considered inhumane. So Birchinger wanted to find a different way to keep elephant numbers down. He knew that a birth control vaccine had been used on wild horses in the western United States, so he decided to try the same drug on elephants. Soon, Makalali Game Reserve signed on. Delsink says the contraceptive works well. They now have about 60 elephants, which is half the number they would have had without birth control.
There's no ways that a 24,000-hectare reserve could sustain an additional 60 elephants over and above what they already have.
Delsink says they still let the elephants have some babies so as not to mess up herd dynamics. But the birth rate is low, there have been no behavioral changes, and if they ever want more babies, they can simply take elephants off the pill. Makalali started doing contraception before they had too many elephants. But other reserves had already reached a crisis point. The elephants had devoured all the trees. So some of those reserves have opted for a more drastic, permanent solution, elephant vasectomies. Mark Stetter, the American veterinarian who developed the technique, says unlike the birth control vaccine, you only have to vasectomize an elephant once, and you only have to vasectomize a few elephants in each game reserve.
All these different matriarchal herds are serviced by a dominant bull, and so by doing this one dominant bull, you're going to have a huge effect in the population.
Then again, it can take decades before the population actually shrinks, even if there are no new babies, because elephants live so long. Some experts say tinkering with elephant reproduction is misguided regardless of the method. Rudy van Arde heads the Conservation Ecology Research Unit at the University of Pretoria. He says South Africa doesn't have too many elephants, just insufficient space. And he says micromanaging elephant numbers is treating the symptoms of the problem when we should be treating the causes.
When you have a toothache, you don't take a painkiller. You may take it for an hour or 2 days or whatever, but you go and see a dentist and you solve the problem.
Van Arde has pushed for the creation of ecological linkages, which allow elephants to move from one park to another. South Africa now offers incentives to landowners who let elephants travel through their property. They've also eliminated fences between certain parks and surrounding areas. One of those parks is Kruger, an enormous national park the size of Denmark. Sam Ferreira is the large mammal ecologist there. He points out a tree whose bark has been scraped away. He says male elephants sometimes do that kind of damage just because they don't get to mate until they're in their 40s.
So what the hell do you do with yourself seriously sexually frustrated for 45 years?
Kruger has spent decades trying to manage elephants. In the past, they killed entire herds. Now, instead of controlling elephants directly, park officials manage the landscape, for instance, by restricting water. Ferreira drives to a clearing with a water trough fed from a well.
All right, so this is an example of one of these places where we provide additional water to the animals. This is a functional one still. We've probably closed down about half of the existing ones that we had. There were up to 300 boreholes in the park.
Because the park has taken away some of these boreholes, or man-made water holes, elephants have to travel longer distances to find water. As a result, more elephants die during droughts and fewer elephants are born. Plus, the animals no longer spend all their time in one place.
So that kind of variability is what we're after, because that variability in how elephants use landscapes give a tree a chance to actually recover.
And indeed, in most areas, the landscape at Kruger looks healthy. Vegetation is plentiful, and you have to look closely to see instances of elephant damage. Ferreira says that's an indication that the Park Service's new approach of restoring natural processes rather than manipulating elephant numbers directly is working. And in fact, he expects this method to become the new norm for wildlife management, not just in South Africa, but also in neighboring countries. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
You can see photos and video footage for this story, as well as read a behind-the-scenes account of the reporting process on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for a podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can follow us all on Twitter I'm under the name Butter Bob. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.